It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening to us and downloading us, streaming us, however you're there. Thank you. My name's Dan. This is the podcast that explores all the secrets in every nook and cranny hiding around the universe. This week on the show, we're chatting to a TV star who is trying to save the environment with his own science podcast. I know, I'm as outraged as you are that there's another science podcast, but I mean, it didn't get the award for the greatest podcast in the history of the universe, did it? It's still very good, though. It's Kel Spellman. He's on this show today. Also, we'll talk about one of the deadliest trees in the world, and I'll answer your questions. Today, they're on Bluetooth, they're on birds flying, and also one of the greatest questions about the woodpecker I've ever heard. It's brilliant. It's on the way. Before then, let's catch up with two of our alien friends who are trying to get back home. This is NNG.
NNG's Energy Challenge.
So, let's get this straight. Humans have got all these different types of energy.
And we still haven't figured out how any of them can get us home.
All right, let's focus. Which is the best, the top, the most exceptional energy of all?
Well, I vote wind.
No, G, you've got wind. That's something different.
Cheeky, hear me out. Wind turbines are cheap. They don't pollute the environment, and wind power is sustainable. You'll never run out of wind.
Except when there isn't any. One problem is that if there's no wind on a particular day, well, your turbine isn't going to be making much electricity. Also, you need a lot of turbines to get a reasonable amount.
All right, what about a good old-fashioned power station? Burning up all that fossil fuel, oil, coal, and gas to produce lots of lovely energy.
Well, you certainly get a lot of electricity out of even a quite small power station, but...
Yeah, I know. All that stuff's gonna run out at some point in time, and it's not great for the planet. I mean, I prefer Zog, but I don't like to think of Earth getting all choked up on greenhouse gases.
True. Well, there's always nuclear power. They can make a tremendous amount of energy from quite a small station.
But the nuclear material can be harmful, and a lot of money needs to be spent making sure it is disposed of carefully.
All right, what about hydropower, surfing the waves?
That's pretty cool stuff. Using the power of oceans and rivers to make the stuff.
Or biomass, using trees and recycling old materials. Recycling's always good, right?
Yeah. Shame these new kinds of energy don't yet make the quantities that are needed. That's why humans use a mix.
That's an interesting idea. A mix. Gee, you're a genius.
I am. Oh, yes, I am.
Why? No one type of energy has got our laser pods firing, but what if we combine them? Use a mix of all these ways to generate energy.
Gotta be worth a try.
So, let's add some fossil fuels.
Not too much, Em.
Just a little. Add in some nuclear power.
Careful what you do with the packet, Em.
Some wind power, hydropower, and a touch of bio. Looks like it's working, G. Quick, get in.
Hey, we're on our way home. Goodbye, Ab. It's been electrifying.
Here it comes! Woohoo!
NNG's Energy Challenge with support from National Grid. Find out more online at funkidslive.com/energy.
It's question time on the show, my favourite part of the podcast. It's when you send over your science questions, anything that's kind of rattling around your head, maybe something that you heard in the playground at school that you thought, there's no way that's true, I've got to check this. Or maybe something that your science teacher told you, and you thought, hang on, is this seriously right? I need to check it through. That's what I'm here for. Leave the question as a review over on Apple Podcasts. That's what Finley and Harrison have done. Hello, you want to know, how does Bluetooth work? Bluetooth is when two tech devices connect to each other. And actually, Bluetooth was named after a 10th century king from Denmark, King Harald Bluetooth. Just some extra for you. Yeah, so Bluetooth is when some tech devices connect to each other. They do this by making a kind of mini computer network. So they talk to each other just like that, and then they send information through low power radio waves. Radio waves that other things like radio stations aren't using. Over these radio waves, electrons are sent through the air. They carry this information, which is then picked up by another bit of technology, which puts all the info, puts all of it together to make what it wanted to get from the first device. So it's kind of a mini computer network talking to each other by sending electrons through radio waves, and all named after a 10th century Danish king, which is pretty cool. This is from Kaya in the UK, who wants to know, how do birds fly? Now, a bird's wing is shaped in a very special way. It's shaped, it's kind of curved at the top. And this means when it's in the sky, when it's soaring through the air, cutting through, air will move faster over the top of the wing than underneath it. Then it means there is more air underneath the wing because it's travelling slowly, and that lifts the wing up. Birds flap their wings to push air downwards, which gives them lift upwards at the same time. But how they stay in the air, it's a lot like an aeroplane. It's really because the air is moving so quickly over the top of the wing, it creates like a mini vacuum, which means the air at the bottom lifts it upwards. Thank you for the question, Kaya. And lastly, this is from Clem, who wants to know, how do woodpeckers keep banging trees without getting a headache? Told you, one of the best questions we've ever had. How have I never thought of this before? Of course woodpeckers should get a headache. All they do all day is bang their beaks onto bark. But they've got some very special things happening in their head, which means they don't. There's a lot of different reasons. They've got an extra thick skull. They've got special spongy bits in it, which act a little bit like a shock absorber in a car. It helps buffer it from the strike. There is also quite a thick muscle in there. And they've got a big bone, which holds the brain straight. Keeps it hanging there. A little bit like a rope that would hold you up if you were climbing a mountain. They've got that. It's a rope in their skull which keeps their brain stable no matter how many times they are smashing their head against a tree. Thank you very much for the question, Clem. If you've got something sciencey that you want answered on the show, you need to leave it as a review over on Apple Podcasts. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, one of our favourite presenters and actors and writers has got a brand new podcast. It's Call of the Wild. It's supported by the World Wildlife Fund as well, so we're all about that. Kel Spellman is on the show to tell us more. Hey, Kel.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on. You okay?
I'm very, very well. Thank you so much for joining us. When was the first, like, idea that you had to make a podcast on our place in the world and how we can try and fix things?
Do you know, it's been one of those things that I've thought about for quite a while, especially with the rise of podcasts. And given that, I think for me, you know, storytelling and having conversations are a big part of kind of driving the climate conversation. It always, you know, kind of felt that it lends itself, the podcast, to be able to do exactly that. So I'd sat on it for a little bit, and then it was around what we're in now. Yeah, it was kind of about a year and a half ago now. It was WWF initially, kind of. We had a little catch-up meeting, and they spoke that they'd been throwing around the idea of maybe delving into the podcast space. And the minute they said it, it just felt like that perfect bit of synergy. You know, two things coming together at the right place and the right time. And given that it was a thing that, you know, charities or non-profits hadn't really delved into this space, I thought that was really exciting. And along with that, it was something that I'd kind of really been keen to do. It just was the perfect match. So we kind of had the first meeting. It was about a year and a half ago, just over. And then from there, it just kind of picked up more and more momentum, I think faster than any of us kind of realised or could have hoped for. And here we are, we've got the first episode out, which is just amazing.
Now, well, it's lovely to have some other players in the Science Wild podcast game. And while you're listening to this, right, let me tell you, one of the hardest things to do if you're hosting a podcast is to get like mind-blowing guests to come on. I think we do pretty well on the Science Weekly. Well, I thought we were doing pretty well until I saw the first guest of Call of the Wild. I mean, if you want anyone to talk about wildlife and saving the world, Sir David Attenborough is up there. Kel, how did this happen? And I know that he's an idol of yours. How important was it having him being such an important voice on your show?
Oh, it was everything, to be honest with you, Dan, and you've said it there. He is one of my heroes and has been since I was a child, really. I think for all of us, you know, we've all grown up with his programming, with his nature documentaries, with his voice. And so for it to happen, even now when it's been out there and I'm talking about, I still find it so surreal. But we were quite fortunate in that where we were doing it with WWF, the podcast, he's been an international ambassador for the charity for decades now. And we had high hopes. We said, look, he would be the perfect first guest, as you've said there, the man who, for me, has given a voice to nature like no one else around the world. And we just thought he would be the perfect starting point. I mean, how could we not at least get the ask in? So through WWF, we were able to get the question to him to see if he would entertain the idea of coming on. And so fortunately and amazingly for myself and for the podcast and for everyone who listens to it, he agreed to come on. So that's how it came about. But it just felt, as I say, like the perfect starting point, you know, for someone who has seen the transformation of the natural world and lived through it and been a part of it over the last, you know, 40 years. I mean, he's had a career spanning over 60 years. And for them to, you know, to know that of his work and how much he speaks out about nature and about wildlife and how we need to protect it and care for it and preserve it, it was just ticked all the boxes. So through that connection, he said yes, and here we are. It kind of happened. It was an absolute dream come true.
You said there, his career traveling the world, looking at so many different creatures, has spanned over 60 years. He's seen everything. He's done everything. What do you ask him, Kel, when you sat there with Sir David Attenborough, like one of the hardest guests to get ever? What's the first question that you ask?
I think the first question I ask is, how are you?
Yeah.
I think it's always a good starting point, always a little check-in. And I think I began by actually saying to him, you know, did he ever... It was something, I don't even know if this made it into the final cut, but I just watched A Life on Our Planet, which is his, almost like it's an autobiographical film of his career, and kind of wanted to say, you know, did you ever think that you would end up, when you started out as a, I think he started out as a producer or a researcher, that 60, 70 years down the line, you'd be here and have had the career that you've had. And then I think off that, my first question was, what inspired his love of nature and the natural world?
One of the Fun Kids presenters with us, a girl called Bex, she had the chance to ask Sir David Attenborough one question. She asked him, where's your favourite part in the world? Favourite place in the world? Which is a brilliant, you know, it's a good question. He's travelled all around the world and he said, my garden in Richmond.
So. I mean, that's the thing. You can go all around the world and you can take the man out of Richmond, but you'll always have Richmond in the man, won't you? I think it'd be the same for me, though, to be honest. You know, I think you've always got a special affiliation, I guess, with the place that you're from. But similarly, he said, you know, his inspiration kind of started when he was a child and when he had, you know, he'd go out to the green spaces around him with his uncle or his grandparents and his parents, and down on a beach, and would be down in the sand and turning over shells or lifting up logs. And he says that that's where it all began. I think, like, for all of us and for all the young people listening as well, your first experience of nature is at home.
Now, you've probably got a few episodes of the show in the can, I would imagine. You know, Sir David Attenborough, that episode is out right now. You've got more incredible guests, I'm sure, down the line. What have you learned from doing these shows, Kel? Like, how have you changed your life to help your place on the planet and to help it survive and thrive?
Yeah, great question. I've learned, which I kind of knew, but it's definitely been enforced through these conversations, is that there is a lot of reason to be hopeful and optimistic about the future. Now, although the climate conversation is very bleak and it has a very negative outlook, which is true because we are at crisis point, but in the same breath, you know, I always believe that you can turn things around. And actually, through the conversations, I've learned the science, the technology, the tools, the systems we need, everything to be put into place to help us make the change and turn things around. It is all out there and it is all available to us. We're not waiting for some miracle invention to be made to go, that's going to fix it. Actually, everything we need is out there to fix it. So I think that was something that I've really held on to, because it can be quite overwhelming when you talk about climate change and what's going to happen to the world in the next 5-10 years. And that was something that has really kind of stuck with me through my conversations. And I guess for me as well is, and I kind of always am keen to do this through my work, is that reminding us that we as individuals all have a voice and we all still have power to be able to make the change and see the change that we want to see. So whether that be through your spending habits, whether that be through, you know, writing to your local MP, or maybe it's joining the school strikes that have been just out of this world, and for me have been one of the biggest parts of shifts, say, in the climate conversation over the last couple of years. All those individual actions, you throw them together, suddenly create one big seismic action and has a ripple effect that I think goes far beyond any of us can ever imagine. So I think that's kind of what I also try and do with myself, is, you know, remember that I have a voice, use that voice, have those conversations, try and drive awareness and education, and also try and inspire. You know, I don't want to sound too high and mighty, but I think that's kind of really part of what I'd really want to do and be trying to do, as well as those little things where I'm traveling less, very much more conscious about what I'm eating. I try and adopt a plant-based diet now. I can't say I'm a saint, you know, it is difficult to do, but I do my best to do that. I recently have moved my energy to 100% renewable. So there's all these kind of little things as well I'm trying to incorporate into my own life and into my own routines, which hopefully then, you know, if everyone does them, it's going to make big change as well.
Now, I'm not really in the business of promoting other people's science and wildlife podcasts, but this is very good. It's Call of the Wild. It's supported by the WWF. Now, I'm not sure if you heard this, Kel. I mean, it was in all the papers. It was the front page last year. But our podcast, The Science Weekly, actually won greatest podcast in the history of the universe. So,
well,
it was an award ceremony on Neptune. I couldn't make it. So, but you know, it's nice that you're in the running for that, I think. It's nice that we've got a good competitor this year.
I think so. I mean, although I'm very happy to play second or third fiddle to this podcast. I think, you know, it speaks for itself. You know, if you're winning awards on Neptune, I'm just happy to be considered around you. Do you know what I mean?
Well, yes. It'll be very tough to displace us. They really do like their science podcasts out there. It's Call of the Wild. It's supported by WWF. You can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts right now. Kel Spellman, thank you for coming on the show.
No, it's my pleasure, and I really do enjoy the show. It's brilliant, so look forward to hearing more.
This week's Dangerous Dan looks at one of the most deadly trees in the world. The Namibian bottle tree grows in the arid, rocky deserts of Africa. Now, their name comes from how they look. They're very thin at the top. A few branches, sparse branches, come out of it. But at the bottom, the trunk is ginormously fat. It's huge. It's squashed. It looks a little bit like a bottle. And it looks dead, really, the plant, with nothing on it. But it lives and it thrives and it kills. The bottle that is its trunk is full to the brim with poison. Its poison has been used by native tribes to put on hunting arrows. It's toxic as well to guard off thirsty animals that might try and get the little bits of water the tree does have. This grows in the desert. There's not a lot of water around. Wildlife has to protect what little water it can get. The Namibian bottle tree does this with deadly poison. And if that poison, if the toxic weren't enough, its branches have thick, sharp, fierce thorns to keep anything away. The Namibian bottle tree has got quite a nice name. The bottle tree sounds quite friendly, but it's one of the deadliest, meanest things in the wild. Right, let's see what's happening deep down inside your body now. With our microbe friends, this is Benny and Mal.
Benny and Mal's body teasers, with support from the Nuffield Council on Bioethics.
Ah, hello again. Sorry about the ruckus. My friends Benny and Mal, you know, microbes that live at the bottom of an old test tube, are single-celled organisms that are very single-minded. Just have a listen. Benny and Mal never agree on anything.
No, I am listening. You're the one that's not listening.
So, lads, what's the hot topic today? Oi, lads, what's the hot topic?
Sorry, mate. Didn't hear you there. Microbe brain Mal won't let me get a word in. Today, we're talking about bionic brains.
There are already quite a few ways to enhance your brain, presuming you have one in the first place.
Hey, come on, Mal. Let's not start with a personal comment.
You started it. As I was saying, surgeons can already help people with brain injury by placing small machines and electricity near or even inside their brains. In some cases, chips can be connected to computers which aren't even attached to the body.
Sounds a bit yucky to me. Like Frankenstein shoving a load of electricity and wires into someone's head.
He's alive! He's alive!
Over 1 million humans struggle with brain injuries and diseases that make life very difficult. Is feeling a bit yucky the best reason you can come up with for disagreeing? What if it helps someone walk or talk again? Never mind brainless, you sound heartless.
All right, I'm not heartless. I do care. I'm just thinking about how things might go wrong. Brains do more than just move us around. They make us, well, us.
You mean, I don't know, if you woke up from an operation, but something's gone wrong with the computer in your head, and now you can only speak Chinese. Is that the sort of thing you have in mind?
Exactly. How confusing would that be for your friends and family?
Presuming they weren't Chinese, you mean? But yes, I suppose at the very least, if I was getting any sort of voice in my brain, I'd want someone to explain exactly how it worked and whether that was likely.
Chances got to be pretty small, but that's a good point. I don't disagree. If you are having any sort of surgery, it's important you understand all the risks.
After all, it's my body. What were we talking about the other day? Most people would agree that having control over your own body is very important. It just gets a bit complicated if you're very poorly or injured and you can't say what you want.
That's why conversations like this are so important. They help other people know how you feel about things.
Now, never mind about helping people get better. Those implants we were talking about that could connect to a computer, they do sound a bit cool. You could play games, record your dreams, and learn stuff off the internet without having to pick up a book.
Yeah, you could just download it all. Does sound massively cool, doesn't it? Just imagine no more homework. Yeah, but thinking it through again, and it wouldn't be fair, would it?
Fairness is boring. Life isn't fair.
Hey, you say that, but you wouldn't think fairness was boring if you were sat in an exam and everyone else had a bionic brain and you had the normal squishy type.
Well, machinery can go wrong. So maybe I'd be better off with my own one au naturel.
Good point. If you start relying on computers, then when they go wrong, what are you left with? An empty brain.
Sounds like someone I know.
It's a brain-busting body bamboozler for sure.
Sure is. Catch you next time.
Benny and Mal's Body Teasers, with support from the Nuffield Council on Bioethics. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Benny and Mal.
It's time for this week's Science in the News. The virus that causes the common cold can boot COVID out of the body's cells. That's what scientists are saying. Some viruses are known to compete to be the one that causes an infection. And experts from the University of Glasgow say that in a battle between COVID and the common cold, it's the cold that wins. Also, experts say that the volcano that erupted last week in Iceland is calming down. Lava at Fagradalsfjall burst through a crack in the Earth's crust, and some fountains turned the sky bright red. Its last eruption was 800 years ago, but this was a small one, and thankfully, no one was in danger up there. And finally, German scientists have looked at an area of seafloor near the South Pole that was recently exposed by a drifting iceberg, and they have found it teeming with animals, sea cucumbers, anemones, and much, much, much more. Loads of wildlife were found down there, stuff that they never knew was around the South Pole. And that is it for this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for listening. If you've got a science question that you want answered on the show, leave it as a review for me over on Apple Podcasts. While you're on Apple, it's one of the best places to hear loads of science shows that we do. You can catch them on Google, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. They're also on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com. And Fun Kids World Children's Radio Station from the UK. You can listen to us all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com.